Finally, Bar Gallardo, just making it before closing. Now let's be honest, we've had a lot to eat and drink at this point. Some restraint needs to be shown.
Little fried fishies?
Dude, if you want to eat little okay, fried fish.
Little ones. Then we're done.
And cheese.
But instead, three more beers, three more tapas. Cheese, bocarones, little fried smelts, and chuletitas, baby lamb chops.
These are super good.
These are super good. See, I'm uncomfortable. The idea of something for nothing.
Right. It's not something for nothing. It's all...
$3 for a glass of wine, it's something for nothing.
Yeah, but just, if somebody can get the math right in the U.S., this will take off.
No, never.
Really?
We will never have tapas culture in America. Ever.
Really?
Ever. You're looking to change the entire day from the minute you get up in the morning in America, nap in the afternoon. Are you out of your mind?
I want to be able to go down, walk to my bar. I want to have a little beer.
Yeah, I want a golden unicorn that shits money. Both of those scenarios are equally likely.
Hey, what's happening, kids? Hope you're all doing okay. Man, my audio in the past couple of episodes sounded like shit, I gotta say. To any of you who did notice, didn't say anything, I'm sorry. But thanks for keeping your mouth shut. I tried some new compression software, and that didn't work out. So, I'm back to the drawing board, or just back to the same way of doing things. Future interviews, by the way, on the show will not be done if the guest has a cell phone either. Poor reception on cell phones, to me, is an absolute show killer. I was listening to talk radio the other day, and this guy had a political analyst on who was making really great points, but the cell reception was so bad, it sounded like the guy was either underwater or was eating a foot long from Subway or something. Host ended it too, apologized to his audience. No, I would never do that. I think it's disrespectful to my guest and my audience. But I may just go to either Skype or demand a landline or do it in person from now on. Got a lot to talk about today. It's going to be a longer show. We're going to be in the kitchen, the actual kitchen, later today. So we're going to be doing that. But I did want to mention this. I was reading this interesting piece on octopus the other day. It got me to thinking. I don't really care for octopus all that much. I love the texture of it, the chewiness, the oddity of eating one of the sea's most scary-looking creatures. But I really don't care for the taste. I find it to be a bit on the funky side. Now, the few times I've had it and really liked it, it was almost pickled. There was this tiny Japanese market here in town years ago. They had this small deli-like section that sold lots of cold, prepared to-go packages of sashimi and prepared sushi. And they'd make this mixed salad with pieces of octopus in it. It was called taco salad, taco being spelled T-A-K-O. Now, that was my first introduction to eating octopus, and I've never tasted it prepared as well as it was in that salad. Now, if you've ever tried cooking octopus, it's an uphill battle. It's easy to overcook. Boil it the wrong way, the texture is super tough, super chewy. Now, some chefs say the key is to include a cork in the boiling water to keep this from happening. I've seen other chefs who pound the shit out of these things before cooking, tenderize them before they're boiled, like you would a tough cut of meat. For me, it just seems like it's not worth the trouble. Especially considering that unless it's either buried under a rich velvety sauce or pickled in some way, it's kind of fishy. But after reading this article, I think it might just be one of those animals I think I'd rather just enjoy alive. You know, it's a mystical sea creature like a starfish or a whale, both of which I would just as soon take a roundhouse kick in the nuts from a steel boot than to try and eat. But this article was about this zoologist in Greece, who was also a diver. He did intensive studies on octopus. He learned about their behavior, studied their anatomy, things like that. Turns out, their death is never swift. They suffer in unimaginable ways. Part of the reason for this is because they have three hearts. Now, you can chop their heads off, but it takes three hearts to stop pumping before they eventually pass. So they suffer a lot. There's no way to kill something quickly when you've got to stop three hearts at once. And I'm not saying any of this to guilt you, you know, into stopping your consumption of this animal at all. Don't get me wrong. This is my thing. All right. I'm just expressing my feelings on it all. I do wonder what you think of octopus, though. Do you like it? Do you dislike it? Are your reasons for eating it or not eating it different than mine or the same? I think it's one of those things that I think a true connoisseur of seafood really appreciates. Again, I like it on sushi, but again, that texture is difficult. Even on sushi, it's like trying to take down a piece of stiff cardboard on a soft bed of rice. I almost wonder if all that chewing burns more calories than you're getting from eating that little chunk of flesh. On the subject of eating and burning calories, I mentioned a book I was just starting, Don't Jog, Eat Bacon. I finished it, and I wanted to share a few bits of it with you. It really is intriguing, I feel, that there are so many theories out there on what to eat, what not to eat, what really works, and what doesn't. I'm not on any diet. I never really have been. I'm just always looking for ways to get creative, try new things. I think diets are stupid because you can't stay on them forever and sustain yourself. You've got to change your lifestyle and stick with that. But it has to be healthy or you'll have health problems or die young. I mentioned my short-lived podcast, Eat, Go, Repeat, and how I didn't feel like I was in the right arena for that. I don't know if anyone is, really. You know, I'm not a guru, but I do like to share things that I find interesting or compelling, and I found this book to be both of those things. Grant Peterson has written a manifesto here, and he breaks it down so simply, it's hard not to follow and stay interested. Each section is written in a few short paragraphs, and the book is so small you literally can read it in the bathroom. I want to share a bit of it, the basis of the book, because I thought it answered a lot of questions that people have about carbs and how we got to this point, because I don't think that's been explained very well. And as I've mentioned, this might not be for everyone, but I hope you can get into this at least a little bit. I want to talk about the food basics first, and then a tiny bit about exercise. And even if you're not looking to lose weight, which most of us are at least a little bit, I found the stuff in this book to be more of a way of life overall, just a healthy way to live. And I hope you're able to appreciate it as much as I do. Right out of the gate, he comes out against carbs. And he makes a lot of good points, most of which are indisputable. We've been brainwashed over the years about what makes us fat and how this all works. Now, if you like eating bacon or any animal flesh or protein, this book will make you happy like Dr. Seuss books made you happy when you were 7. On the other hand, if you have an addiction to climbing Pasta Mountain or eating an entire baguette for breakfast, this book might break your heart. It comes down to insulin, but it starts with carbohydrates. When you eat cotton candy, bread, fruit, soda, or pasta, your body converts the carbs in them to a kind of a sugar called glucose. And the glucose goes into your blood. Now, he uses the term sugar and glucose interchangeably throughout the book. When you eat carbs, your blood glucose rises. Your blood sugar rises. All right, that's the same thing. When you eat carbs, your blood sugar rises. Your body treats glucose in your blood as poison. And your pancreas leaps to the rescue by secreting insulin, which is a hormone that determines where you get your energy from, what you burn for calories. When you eat carbs and raise your sugar, then your insulin, you burn sugar, not fat. You can think of this as your body's way of lowering the levels of poison glucose and burning it up. So yes, the insulin gets the glucose out of your blood, saving your life, and into your cells to be burned as energy so you can move, walk, run, ride a bike, whatever. And that's the last good thing that insulin does. Insulin converts calories to fat. Even the calories from fat-free food become body fat. Insulin stores fat on your hips, your belly, your back, wherever you tend to pack it in. Insulin puts it there. Insulin prevents you from using body fat as fuel. When you exercise hard and long, you think you're burning body fat, but you're not. Insulin won't let you burn off body fat. Insulin also keeps you hungry. It makes you want more of the same carbohydrates that started the cycle in the first place. And it doesn't stop there. Insulin is also a force behind many of the diseases we either live with or we fear. Reducing insulin levels is the key to losing fat and a key to getting healthier. And there's only one way to do it. You have to quit eating carbohydrates. Not fat, not protein, carbohydrates. Insulin is the problem. Eating carbohydrates drives up insulin. Cutting way back on carbs lowers your insulin levels, and that is the solution. Most carbohydrates are cheap and tasty, so we eat a lot of them, as munchies, as main meals, as quick pick-me-ups and energy boosts, as food mops for a sloppy plate, as holiday and special occasion treats. We drink them as sodas, sports drinks, juice, and alcohol. The worst carbohydrates are the pure sugars and syrups that come in candy and cookies and soda. And the refined carbohydrates, like wheat without the bran or germ, for instance, that are used in white bread and fancy pastries. These simple carbs send your sugar and insulin levels skyrocketing, and they do it right after you've eaten them. If your body was burning fat before you ate them, eating them jacked up your insulin levels and put a halt to all that fat burning. The so-called good carbohydrates are natural, unprocessed ones like fruit, root vegetables, and whole grains. They're complex because the carbs are attached to a plant fiber, so it takes them longer to break down into glucose. So there's a smaller and delayed increase in blood sugar and insulin compared to the carbs in, say, a Coke. But when the topic is weight gain, any carbohydrate breaks down to sugar and leads to high insulin levels and fat making. It's easy to avoid the worst carbs, but the good carbs are even more dangerous because, like the enemy you don't recognize, they trick you. You gobble and guzzle them with abandon because they're natural, and you've been told that they're good for you. But here's the truth. The banana you eat with a glass of fresh-squeezed organic orange juice does more to keep you hungry and fat than the candy bar and Coke that you don't go near. At least the candy and Coke make no pretense of being good for you. The best carbs are the least harmful ones, and they're greens, especially leaves, kale, chard, cabbage, spinach. It's not because of their nutrition, but because they have these three things in their favor. They're mostly water, they're low in sugar, and what sugar they do have is bound up in cellulose, so it's not completely digestible. Here is how to stop being so hungry all day long, day after day. There are two ways to avoid that soul-crushing feeling of being hungry. Eat until you have no more room and get fatter, or eat lots of fat and almost no carbohydrates and don't get fat. When you limit your carbs to 50 grams or less a day, now that's a slice of bread and a banana, for instance, and then replace those carbohydrates with good fat from animals, animal products, and selected plants like coconuts, macadamia nuts, avocados, and olives, you get your calories from stored body fat, and that is what stops hunger. Even if you're relatively lean, like me, you have plenty of body fat to supply your energy needs. Cut the carbs, eat more fat, tame that raging appetite. That's how it works. I know I mentioned fasting on the program last time. When you cut out all food, including carbs, your blood insulin level will drop. You'll start to burn body fat, and you'll stop being hungry. But starvation, even if only for a day, is a dreary and unnecessary way to get there. Besides, when you starve one day, it's easy to eat too much the next day. If you want to fast to reduce insulin, there are two ways that work just as well and don't make you miserable with cravings. First is the 18-hour fast. Here's how that works. For a 24-hour period, clump all of your high-fat, low-carb eating into 6 hours. Pick any 6-hour period, 8 to 2 o'clock, noon to 6, 6 to 12, whatever you like. This approach will ward off hunger while you fast the subsequent 18 hours. The 18 hours of fasting gives your body time to burn up whatever glucose is in your blood, which reduces the insulin and fat storage. This eating pattern is a perfectly healthy way to eat forever, although real life and social pressures like business lunches and stuff will definitely interfere. Then there's the all-day 90% fat fast. For 24 hours, eat nothing but cheese, homemade unsugared whipped cream, coconut oil, olive oil, butter, bacon, 2 to 4 ounces of fatty meat, or up to 6 eggs, depending on how big you are. Let the amount follow your hunger. But the point is to concentrate on eating or drinking fat. That's why it should be pork bacon, not turkey bacon. Cream, not just whole milk. If you like brie, get triple cream. On this non-fast fast, you get to eat whenever you want, and you won't be tempted to wash down a pound of bacon with a quart of cream because without the insulin to make you ravenous, you simply won't be hungry for that much food. When 90% of your calories come from fat and 0 come from carbohydrates, your insulin plummets, just as it would in a water-only fast, but with less hunger. In the 2.4 million years before the 1400s, everybody ate local foods. If you lived in Africa, you ate local wild game and a few roots, not quinoa or acai berries. If you were an Eskimo, you ate seal liver, polar bears, and fish, not nectarines from Chile in December. Grocery store variety is convenient, but it's unnatural. And it isn't a nutritional requirement. You might think that your choices will be limited if you give up or severely cut back on carbs. But here's a list of no-carb and low-carb foods. You tell me if you can't exist on this stuff. Bacon, sardines, brie, bison, sole, cheddar cheese, ground beef, clams, cottage cheese, ham, mussels, liver, oysters, gorgonzola, pulled pork, scallops, rabbit, shrimp, mascarpone cheese, ribs, chicken, parmesan cheese, steak, rock Cornish game hens, provolone cheese, tongue, halibut, salmon, turkey, eggs, blue cheese, whipped cream, olive oil, tea and coffee. Those are all no-carb or low-carb foods. Here are some foods that are low enough in carbs to eat at any meal, but not at every meal, every day. Asparagus, olives, tomatoes, bell peppers, onions, zucchini, broccoli, purple cabbage, dark chocolate, Brussels sprouts, romaine lettuce, coconut, seaweed, collard greens, spinach, Greek yogurt, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, kale, macadamia nuts, mushrooms. Cook and combine and season all these things in different ways. You'll have plenty of variety and an ideal diet. You can have a meal of salmon, coconut, collard greens with butter and macadamias. Serve that to your guests. They will not complain about a lack of variety. And you'll stay healthy and it'll help you burn fat. I know it sounds weird. The thing is, you eat less often when you eat more fat and fewer carbs. He says this point cannot be overstated. We've all heard that it's healthier and better for your weight to eat frequent, smaller meals rather than fewer big ones. The number usually recommended is 6 small meals instead of 3 big meals. That's nonsense, and is especially bad advice when the recommended small meals and snacks are supposedly healthy foods like fruit, whole grains, carrots, and the odd finger sandwich. Eating small, carb-dense meals will maintain a constant high level of glucose and insulin. It'll prevent you from burning fat and will keep you hungry all day long. If you doubt this, try it for a week and you'll watch your 6 small meals a day turn into 6 medium-sized ones, or possibly 3 large meals with 3 snacks in between. And you're thinking, it's fine, 6 meals a day. It's not a willpower problem. It's just what happens when you fill yourself with carbohydrates. You get hungry all the time. Instead, cut the carbs and fill up on fat. Now, too much protein will make you fatter, not stronger. When you eat more protein than your body can use in a few hours, the extra turns into glucose and raises your blood sugar. The rise in blood sugar from eating protein isn't as quick or dramatic as it is when you eat carbs, but it does go up. Think of excess protein as a sort of carbs light. Get enough, but don't think chopping down pounds of animal muscle is going to make you stronger. It doesn't work like that. 30 grams of protein per meal is about all you can use. That's 4.5 eggs or 3 eggs plus cheese, 1.5 cans of sardines, or 3 to 5 ounces of beef, or 12 slices of bacon. When there's a food label, read it for the protein measure. Let's say you're a heavily muscled man over 200 pounds and you want to grow even more muscles. 100 to 120 grams of protein. That's 5 eggs plus a cup of cottage cheese and an 8-ounce steak. If you eat that in one day, that's enough. If you're not that big and you're considering, you know, maybe you're obsessed with size and you want to get bigger and stronger, 70 to 80 grams is fine. Average-sized women do well on 55 to 70 grams of protein a day. Petite women, 45 to 50. The key is you want to get most of your calories from fat. To burn fat, you have to eat fat. It's not that eating fat in and of itself makes you burn it. It's that carbs and excess protein stop you from burning fat by raising your blood sugar and insulin. Fat doesn't raise your blood sugar and insulin, but if you combine fat with carbohydrates, the carbs will raise your sugar and the sugar will raise your insulin. The insulin then will make you store all those calories, including the fat calories, as body fat. You'll get fat on hamburgers when you eat the buns. Without the carbs and the glucose and the insulin spike that follows, fat becomes a fuel. Burn it up when you move around, and it keeps you from feeling hungry, so you aren't always looking for your next meal. Odd as it may seem, eating fat not only doesn't make you fat, it's the only way to lose fat. You need food, not a pyramid or a plate. The government has been advising us on what to eat and how much for more than 100 years, dumbing it down for us in a series of wheels, charts, and pyramids. The early charts and wheels allowed healthy amounts of meat, butter, and fats. But by anti-carb standards, there was still far too much bread, cereal, and potatoes. Fear of fat and beef took hold in the 1970s. And the famous food pyramid embodied that by putting bread, cereal, rice, or pasta as the basis of every meal. Adult obesity rates skyrocketed in 1990, just about the time that kids who were born in the 1970s had time to become adults and gain weight from eating the way the government had told them to. In 2011, the food pyramid was officially replaced by MyPlate, which has no mention of fats. Presumably, there are some in the protein and the side dish of dairy, but since we're told to avoid saturated fats, which are all dairy fats, those are saturated, you're probably meant to interpret the dairy to mean non-fat milk, yogurt, and cottage cheese. Since fat is so important to your health, as it is really the only nutrient that doesn't raise insulin, its absence is evidence that something's wrong with MyPlate. Food is a political issue, and politicians, hoping for a long career in politics, aren't going to endorse an agenda that makes it hard to sell wheat, corn, or potatoes. Here are things you should never eat. Grains, soda, fruit juice, and sweets. Now and then, eat roots that aren't fluffy potatoes, whole fruit, nuts, and seeds. Things you can eat whenever you feel like eating. Above the ground vegetables, especially leaves, and especially dark leaves. It's not that they're so full of accessible nutrients, it's that they're high in water and low in carbs, and that the carbs they have are bound up in cellulose, so they aren't fully digestible. Ingestible carbs can feed your gut bacteria. Things you want to eat a lot of: young, fatty, oily fish like herring, wild salmon, sardines, and trout from the coldest waters. Eggs, mammal meat, especially fatty meats from grass-fed or wild animals. Cheese, cream, butter, macadamia nuts, olive and coconut oils. He talks about breakfast, the most important meal of the day, to skip. Ask the next dozen strangers you see, what's the most important meal of the day? If they've been properly brainwashed by the grain sellers, they'll say breakfast. When you're a carb eater, your body's nocturnal activity involves burning sugar for 7 to 8 hours. So by morning, your stomach will be growling for you to put something into it. If you skip breakfast, your blood sugar might be too low by late morning, and you'll feel starved, maybe lethargic, and definitely desperate for food. That's why for a sugar burner, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. It's different for a fat burner. Since you're adapted to getting your energy from fat, your blood sugar doesn't spike and fall off a cliff the way a sugar burner's does. It's far more stable, and you don't wake up raring to dive into a high-carb breakfast. The pull of ritualistic eating is still there, but it's different from the desperation hunger of a sugar burner. You can satisfy the ritual with fatty coffee or tea, which keeps your blood sugar low enough to keep you burning fat until lunch or maybe longer. Then you can eat a fatty burger with cheese and bacon for lunch, and you'll cruise into the evening, no hunger, no problem. I'm going to talk a little bit about exercise, and then we'll get off the topic altogether. I hope I'm not boring any of you. I hope you find at least a little bit of this interesting. As the book says, don't jog. Now this I found alarming because I lost a lot of my weight from eating a little leaner, knocking out the carbs, and especially the alcohol, and jogging, raising my heart rate and keeping it there for an extended period of time. It turns out my fat burning came from knocking the carbs out. I still think that raising your heart rate into what's called the fat burning zone will still do the job. Grant has something else to say about that. Humans have bigger brains than wild animals. And when it comes to exercise, that might be part of the problem. We combine facts and falsehoods in ways that animals can't, and come up with crazy ideas about exercise. There's no animal equivalent to the human jog. And before the moon landing, jogging was a fairly freakish behavior, even for us. Then, in 1968, Kenneth Cooper's best-selling book, Aerobics, triggered the over-exercising boom, and all we've gotten is more tired, injured, and fatter. Watch any public half or full marathon, and you'll see desperate people suffering long hours of ineffective, even dangerous exercise. We're so used to the idea of suffering being productive, studying for a test, scrubbing road rash, swallowing foul-tasting medicine, that even when it's not healthy, we think it is. Jogging feels healthy because it's dreadful, but it's the kind of dreadful that's counterproductive. Your body responds to too much running by releasing cortisol, a stress hormone. Cortisol triggers a process called gluconeogenesis, in which your muscles, made up of protein, break down into glucose. A lifestyle that includes hours of running every week can grind down your muscle, which causes the gaunt, wiry look of so many world-class marathon runners. Hey, that's me. The healthiest and arguably best-looking bodies in the sports world belong to sprinters, gymnasts, rock climbers, and dancers. They may have good genetics, but it is short, intense, straining, gasp-inducing exercise that shapes their bodies. And guess what? They don't jog. Jogging doesn't build strength or fitness. It just trains muscles to tolerate more jogging. And in the real world, that's close to useless. You don't jog to a bus that's about to take off, or jog away from bad guys who are chasing you on foot. You sprint. You haul ass. Nobody ever jogged for a touchdown, or down the basketball court on a fast break, or across the tennis court to return a shot. Jogging's reputation for being healthy doesn't jibe with reality. Do it if it's a way that you like to wind down or relax, but don't do it for your physical health. So you probably ask, what kind of exercise works best then? Short, intense exercise that makes your muscles burn and make you gasp for more air to supply the burning muscles with oxygen. It has to be hard. If you can talk or watch TV or maintain the effort level for, say, more than 5 minutes, it's too easy. If you want maximum return on your exercising minutes so you can make it as short as possible, you need to work as hard as you can. This idea is the opposite to the exercise is fun notion that really drives the exercise industry. But he wants to be clear about this. Skiing, hiking, riding a bike, surfing, those are things that are fun. But the exercise is incidental to the fun. You get exercise, yes, but it really is incidental to just being out there having a good time. Fun is great, but it's an inefficient way to get fit. He's not saying don't do it. That stuff could be the best part of your life. He's just saying that when the goal is improved cardiovascular, stronger muscles, injury resistance. Short, super intense exercise works much better and much faster than play or recreation. Maximize efficient exercise. It's barely bearable, and it's not even close to fun. Your efficient time exercising can be as short as 3 to 7 minutes a day. 7 minutes is 1/200th of your entire day. When you're finished, you won't feel wasted like you do after a long run or a ride. You'll fully recover in a few minutes. You'll have the rest of the day to work, play, travel, explore, study, read, have sex, ride your bike, hike, walk the dog, whatever you want to do. Short, intense workouts make your fun exercise easier and leave more time for life. He also says if your workout requires special clothing, it's the wrong kind of workout. Workout clothing is half unnecessary, half scam. If you already own grippy shoes that flex, loose or stretchy pants, you've got plenty of workout clothing already. Anything that allows squats and jumping jacks is fine for a 3 to 7 minute workout. You'll be finished with your workout in the time that it takes to change your costume. And with the workout so short, you won't sweat and stink up whatever you're wearing. The jeans you chop wood in, the t-shirt you'd never wear in public, the linen slacks that are not too tight, the blouse that makes you look 10 years older and 20 pounds heavier, they're perfect. Shoes? Easy. Flat, low-heeled shoes or sandals. Nothing with raised heels that pitch you forward. Or you can go barefoot. If a new workout wardrobe supercharges your motivation, go to town, but spend twice as much on kettlebells. Okay, one more thing and then we're going to move on. A lot of people exercise all the time. They say, I'm exercising like crazy. I'm watching my diet. I'm still not losing weight. Why? Here's why. If you eat sugar, you cannot exercise off your fat. The people who have complained to me that they can't lose their weight have not stopped drinking wine or beer or eating sandwiches or eating bagels and things like that, eating whole grains. They're exercising their asses off, but they're not losing weight, and they wonder why. This is why. If you've spent years trying to work off your fat to no avail, here's a way. Understanding this will help you stop trying to do something that's truly impossible and beating yourself up for failing at it. Most doctors, nutritionalists, and the government still say weight management is simply a matter of burning more calories than you eat. Those are the flat earthers, the continental drifters, the creationists of weight management. What they say, that eating less and exercising more is a sustainable way to lose weight. It ignores the effects of insulin. Weight gain or loss is all about insulin. Any discussion of calories eaten versus calories burned must include insulin's role in determining whether you burn sugar or fat, and something called homeostasis. Homeostasis is your body's way of balancing input and output and keeping you alive without your having to think about it. For instance, shivering to stay warm or sweating to cool down. When shivering alone won't warm you up, your desire to stay comfortable makes you put on a coat. And when it's hot out, it makes you strip off layers. When your body needs help keeping you comfortable, homeostasis calls you to action. Consider this. There are 3,500 calories in a pound of fat. Whether the fat comes from a salmon, a pig, a pile of soybeans, or your belly, an hour of strenuous exercise burns 700 to 900 calories, depending on how big you are and how much you're able to suffer. But let's use this 700 calorie figure for now, because it's an effort level most people can sustain if they're forced to suffer for, like, say, an hour in a jog. To lose 1 pound, mathematically, you have to exercise at 700 calories an hour for 5 hours, while consuming 0 calories. The problem is that exercise makes you hungry. And when you're burning glucose, because we've not yet trained your body to burn its own fat for energy, you won't be able to exercise for more than 2 to 3 hours without requiring more glucose, supplied by more carbs. For every 700 calories of carbs you eat, you have to exercise another hour to stay on track for the 3,500 calories you need to burn off a pound of fat. That extra hour of exercise, in turn, is another hour spent working up an appetite. If you survive a 5 to 7 hour jog and burn that 3,500 calories, you're going to be starving in a few hours, and you're going to eat them back, because homeostasis insists on a balance of output and input. Willpower has nothing to do with it. Your body will get back those lost calories, and your long jog will have been for nothing. So if you've been jogging for the sole purpose of burning calories, you now have a scientific basis for knocking it off. Exercise tones muscles and keeps the blood flowing, calms you down, flushes you out, maybe even jacks up your endorphins. It's a good thing for a lot of reasons, but weight loss is not one of them. So enjoy your hikes, your walks, your rows, your bike rides, your swims, without any regard for the calories that they burn up. The book's available from Amazon. It's under 10 bucks. I'll put a link on the website, mylifeasafoodie.com. I highly urge you to check it out. If nothing else, it's a very entertaining read. Hey, it's been a while since we went to the kitchen, and James Spencer at Basic Brewing Radio told me, listen, he thinks it's a highlight of the show when we go into the kitchen, and I agree, we haven't done it in a while, so let's do it now. Follow me. Okay, today we're making chicken with chilaquiles and green salsa. This is one of those free ball recipes, okay? So don't expect any exact ingredients for this. I don't like to cook like that, and frankly, neither should you. It's not fun. This is fun. Chilaquiles is basically corn chips in either salsa or mole. Ours will be green salsa, but before we make the salsa, we've got to make the chips. Now, you can go buy a bag of tortilla chips from the grocery store, but making them yourself is easy and fresh, and of course, that's what we're going to do today. It's super simple. All right, we've got some fresh tortillas here, and we're going to slice these into 8 triangle shapes. So what we want to do here is just cut a stack halfway down the middle, and then we're going to cut the other direction, so you're going to have 4 triangular-shaped chips from each tortilla, and then one more time, so you have 8. Now, if you want to cut these into long strips instead, you can do that. I'm not going to stop you. Whatever you want to do, just make some chips. All right, we're going to heat oil in a deep pan. We're going to get that to around 325 degrees. And we're going to toss these in the oil a handful at a time. Now, these cook fast, all right? So use a slotted spoon or a pair of cooking tongs. Move them around the oil. Dip them, dunk them, so they don't stick together. These literally will be done inside of a minute. All right, once they start to turn a light golden brown color, we're going to remove them from the oil onto a plate that we have lined here with a paper towel. And we're going to give them a nice dusting of salt. And it really is that simple. Just keep repeating this process until you make all the chips that you need. And once you've fried those chips, what we're going to do now, we're going to chop about a dozen tomatillos into quarter chunks. Now, tomatillos, they look like green tomatoes, but they're not tomatoes. They're in the nightshade family, which is actually a close relative to the gooseberry. Common misnomer. People think that tomatillos are green tomatoes, but they're not. Very weird, right? Now, they've got this husk on them that protects them, so you want to remove the husks. Wipe them clean with a little wet rag, or you know, you can dip them in water if you want. And we're going to chop these bastards up. We're going to puree them in a blender when we're done here, so just toss them in the blender as you go. You're going to need about 2 to 3 cups of shredded cooked chicken for this dish. Now, I assume you all know how to cook a chicken, so we're not going to go into that. So if you have any leftover chicken from that fat bastard you cooked the other night, you can do. That'll work. Or just cook up a couple chicken thighs or some breasts. You want to season them, of course, because as Emerald says, I don't know where you buy your chicken, but I buy mine. Damn thing doesn't come seasoned. Okay, so tomatillos are all cut up. We've got those in a blender. Now we're going to add a clove of garlic, about 1/4 cup of fresh cilantro leaves, about 2 teaspoons of lime juice, and we're going to hit it with some salt, some black pepper, and I'm going to toss in a little small serrano pepper here. Now we're going to be adjusting this once it's pureed. This is just a start. Never go high with ingredients. Always go low. We can always add more later. Cover the blender tight. Put your hand on top. Keep it from popping off. You don't want it to bukkake your face. And put the pedal to the metal. Yeah, dude. Now I ask you, does your blender do that? My blender's fucking metal every time I run it. Okay, now it's blended. Let's taste it. Yeah, mine needs some salt. And maybe a bit more lime juice. I'm going to add that now. And we're going to re-blend this for a few more seconds. Michelle tells me I'm not afraid of salt, and that's true, I'm not. As Mike Fantaggio says, whenever people ask him what the difference is between his food and everyone else's, he says one word, salt. Okay, taste. Yeah, that's rocking. All right, now listen. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe you want the salsa to prolapse your anus. If so, go ahead, add another pepper. Or go for it. Add an habanero. Add two if you want. It's your salsa, your call. Right, so now we're going to divert our attention to something else for 1 second here. We're going to stir together a cup of sour cream with just enough milk so this can be easily poured. I'll explain this later, all right? Just whip that together. Stir it real nice and make it nice and fluid. If it needs more milk, add a little more milk. And after you've done that, we're going to take our salsa here. We're going to pour about a cup to a cup and a half of this salsa into a saucepan that's over medium heat and get that bad boy to a simmer. And when you start seeing some bubbles, that's you've got a good simmer going. And once it begins to simmer, you're going to add your shredded chicken and stir that in there. And give that chicken a few minutes in the salsa to heat through. Then we're going to add our tortilla chips. Now you want these to soften and absorb the salsa, so give these about another minute. I like to crush them up a little bit. Now, this will also further thicken the dish too. And if you've seasoned those chips with salt, be careful here because this is going to up the salt content. So go low with the salt up until this point, all right? Check the seasoning now. Make sure it tastes just how you want it. If it needs salt and pepper, you can add it now. And that's about all the cooking we need to do for this dish. We're going to turn the heat off. We're going to pour this into bowls. Garnish with some cilantro and a few more tortilla chips. And then drizzle some of that sour cream mixture across the top. And that is chicken chilaquiles with green salsa. And that's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Audio in this episode courtesy of CNN. Music in this episode from Mimosa. If you like the music, use the links on the website to purchase the songs and support Mimosa. MyLifeAsAFoodie.com. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Adios, everybody.